We will now hear argument in the case of Edinburgh College Park Apartments et al. Versus Edinburgh University Foundation and Dr. Woolman. Mr. Woolman.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Wolford, and I represent Edinburgh College Park Apartments and three other plaintiff appellants in this appeal. I already spoke earlier about reserving 3 minutes for all.
Granted.
Thank you.
So Mr. Wolford, if the university decided to up the meal plan requirement and said the students, instead of having to buy 20 meals, have to buy 40 meals in the dining halls, would the local restaurants have a cause of action?
Assume they didn't mandate broccoli.
Well, that would be its own cause of action. Well, I hadn't really thought about that, but the whole parietal rule is something that...
Same scenario here. Instead of having to live on campus, you've got to eat on campus. You can't go to the local pizza shops. You can't go to the local hoagie stores. You've got to eat here. Right. At least twice as much as you used to. Do those pizza stores and hoagie shops have causes of action?
Well, they may. When you have a state university, Your Honor, the primary objective is to provide a quality education at the lowest possible cost. It's not to provide student housing. It's not to provide meals.
But the issue is not what are they primarily responsible for, but what thing are they tasked with under state law and which of their actions are mandated with or consistent with the state mandate, the state law mandate. Not what is their, we're not ranking their obligations, but whether or not what they're doing basically is consistent with or discharges a state mandated.
Well, it has to be more than consistent with an overall framework of a constitutional duty and some statutes. You have to actually look at the statute.
Well, they are obligated to provide housing, though, aren't they?
Let me just finish with him, and then I'll move on, Your Honor.
Okay, that's actually done. Good job. Good job.
If the so
shut up, McKee, I'm talking to his people.
I would never say that.
More people should say that.
I was
He's starting again.
If the purpose of doing that was to raise money for the university, I think it would violate antitrust law. If the purpose was for some other reason that had something to do with actually running
the university. So we need to get behind the reason? We need to get behind the reason as to why the students have to live on campus and why they have to eat on campus?
Well, that's where the clear articulation of state policy comes from. I mean, if you look at this case, I've identified a number of overt acts that this anti-competitive agreement embodied, both by the university and by the foundation. My opponents have chosen two to focus on, which is fine with me because we can look at those two. One is constructing the project itself, and then the second is the 2011 housing restriction requiring expanding, you know, to the two-year program instead of the one-year program.
Was it
independent? They're all part of the same conspiracy.
So was it an antitrust violation in 89 when this housing protocol was put in place?
It may have been. Any housing requirement, if the purpose is to make money at the expense of private sector, it may well violate antitrust laws. But, you know, I'm focused on the facts of this case.
Well, and let's, the facts of this case suggest a need to address a threshold question, I think, and that is because defendants claim here that the only anti-competitive conduct that's at issue is conduct of the university. What is it that the foundation did that was anti-competitive?
They allowed the university to circumvent mandatory construction requirements. And They helped them do it. I mean, in an ordinary situation, when you look at, well, what is the clear articulation of state policy?
Wasn't the foundation acting at the university's direction here?
At their request, not their direction. They're a private entity. The university doesn't have any control over them. They asked them to help them circumvent statutory requirements, and the foundation said, okay, we'll help you.
Let me focus on what you were saying earlier about the purpose. I forget about the question that you didn't get back to me, and I'll come back to that. But you mentioned if the purpose is to, and then I think you said something like circumvent the antitrust laws, or basically you put a profit motive into the purpose. If the purpose is one of profit, then you're saying there's a problem. But in terms of housing, especially living on campus, we may well be in a situation where it's, I don't mean mixed motive in the typical Persky Title VII situation, but it may be a mixed motive in that I could easily say a university, and most of them do, want to have first and second year students living on campus as part of their educational mission with the Brown University, but along with that, they're going to derive profit. Now, are you saying that we need to look at how they're prioritizing that? If their main objective is the money, then there's a problem. If their main objective is getting kids into the community and the learning experience that comes from a group of people living together, then it's okay?
Well, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of parietal rules, but my response to your question is, at this point in the process, we were dismissed on a motion to dismiss. We have a complaint with an averment that says that second thing, the laudable goal, the in-local purchasing, is not part of this. It's all about money, and it's about economic gain in the local student housing market. That's what we're here to talk about. So the other idea, although it's interesting, and maybe some facts.
Well, you answer the question, even though that's not why you came here today, it's why I came here today, so help me out with this.
Right.
Do we then start looking into the purpose?
Well, if you folks agree with me, and we remand it back, we're going to find out why they did it, because there's going to be factual discovery that I was deprived of. But and I think it's going to ultimately affirm what we've averred in the complaint, is that this was done purely for financial. If you look at the timing of it, what was done, why it was done, I think it's pretty clear what the reason was. It wasn't because the people that were living directly across the street, 100 yards away, needed to be close to the campus. That wasn't why they did it.
Let me ask a hypothetical of my own that has nothing to do with broccoli. Let's suppose that the foundation company built the Highlands, maintained the property, but in this hypothetical there's one important difference. The university never lengthened its residency requirement of any kind. Would there be any anti-competitive conduct under this fact?
Well, there would be. I noted in the brief that I filed that they didn't just sort of countenance it, but put them on the campus.
Isn't that where most on-campus housing is related?
They're owned by the school, yes, but they're not the school. The foundation is a private entity. I mean, when I was a kid, my mom used to have this expression, you can't have your cake and eat it too, and I never understood as a kid what that meant.
Your mom used to have that expression from my mom.
Okay, well, there you go. So, and I finally figured out what she meant was, you can't keep the cake and look at it because it's pretty, and then also eat it too. You got to pick one or the other. And what these folks did is they circumvented the statutory requirements of the statute to do something that they wouldn't have been allowed to do. And by doing that, they privatized me. They were going to go to the private sector in order to do that, and now they want to say, but we're really the same.
What is it they did that they wouldn't have been allowed to do?
I went through the statutory provisions in the what they call the PASHI code, which is the enabling provision of the Pennsylvania State Higher Systems Education. It runs the state universities. When they first promulgated that statute, the state universities didn't have construction authority. They couldn't have done this. The Department of General Services, DGS, built all Commonwealth buildings under the procurement code, and they had competitive bidding, advertising, and other requirements. About 8 years after that statute was promulgated, they amended it, the legislature did, and they said, we're going to allow state universities to do what DGS has been doing. And they brought over the same requirements, advertising, competitive bidding. The legislature wanted to be fair. The problem is, for the university, this wouldn't have been constructed because they didn't have the state funding to do it. So what do? They privatized by going around the statute.
So what if Edinburgh had just increased the residency requirement and not built anything? Same impact on the landlords. Would that be in violation of antitrust laws?
Well, they're not acting with a private party. I mean, that's the whole point. They went to a private party to get around their own requirements. And so by doing so, they sort of hung the foundation out to dry.
Let's turn to the Parker-related issues that are here. Did the district court get it right? I'm sure your answer is going to be no, but the district court essentially applied ipso facto immunity, didn't it?
Yeah, and the district court didn't get it right because she didn't apply the Mid-Cal test. and I go into some detail about what was wrong there. If you look at the ipso facto language from Hoover.
Mid-Cal applies ordinarily to private entities, is that right?
No, Mid-Cal can apply, well, technically yes, because Town & Howley would apply to municipal governments and that sort of thing. Yeah. And here we have, the foundation is a private entity. But Mid-Cal also applied to the conduct of the state officials. If you look at A.D. Bedell, for example, it applies to the entire scheme that you're analyzing.
Why would it fail the Mid-Cal test? Had the judge applied it?
In A.D. Bedell?
No, in this case. Why are you saying that the court erred? If I just said, well, this court erred not applying the Mid-Cal test.
Yeah. The first thing that you have to do, if you look at Hoover, Hoover says if the state legislature passes a statute, that's a state action, ipso facto immunity. If a high court of the state acts in a legislative capacity, issues a ruling that's legislative in nature, ipso facto immunity. If an executive branch agency official does something, that requires what the court said, closer analysis. And the closer analysis that this court used in A.D. Bedell is the Mid-Cal test. And so here you have essentially, I don't know how many people at PASH you were involved with this, but certainly with the student housing restriction, one executive branch official.
How would the result be different? Had the court applied Mid-Cal?
The first test is miserably failed. And one of the things that I got into is in the Aurora case, which is factually on all fours with this case, it's out of Colorado.
Is the university it's on appeal, isn't it?
It's
on appeal. It's on appeal, isn't it?
It is on appeal. And I checked it yesterday and there's no decision yet.
Is the university structured the same in that case?
Is it similar? In terms of the policy? If you look at the PASHI statute on this one, with regard to, you have to look at which policy goes with which action. If you look at the policy that goes with the construction, then you look at Section 203A.1 of the PASHI statute that says competitive bidding, blah, blah, blah. If you look at the student housing restriction, then you got to look at, well, what authorized the one institution president, only one person, to change that? And it's very generic. It's like one sentence, and it just says the university president can issue policies to further the mission, that sort of thing. That's almost the exact same language that was looked at by the district court in Aurora. And he said that's not good enough, even with a foreseeable test, to think that the institution president would pass a housing policy for economic purposes. And so we're on all fours with that.
In your reply brief, you make a suggestion that Halley analysis makes sense. I think that's how you put it.
I didn't say that.
Is that a fallback position or what?
Well, it's inconsistent with A.D. Bedell. And A.D. Bedell, this court said, if you have an executive official that's just kind of doing their own thing, which we allege is part of what's going on here, you look at Mid-Cal. The court didn't really get into an additional discussion about, well, sometimes circumstances are such that maybe we should only apply the Halley test. But in Arroyo, the court looked at that and said the relationship between the state and this state university is very similar to the relationship between the state and a municipality. And for that reason, rather than apply both parts of the test, they only apply the first part of the test, which I'm comfortable with, because in this case, the test has miserably failed.
Mr. Wolford, we'll have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McCulloch.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Matthew McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of Edinburgh University Foundation. Your Honors, this case is controlled by Parker. Representing the foundation, I've found no simpler way to say this, but the university drove this bus, and the foundation was along for the ride.
All right, you're a private foundation.
Yes.
Why shouldn't Mid-Cal review apply?
Because the actions that caused the alleged antitrust injury, which is the threshold question we have to have answered, directly resulted from actions of the state. actions of the university.
What were the actions here?
Well, as alleged by the plaintiffs, or the appellants, the actions include...
Well, it's mostly dismissed, and that's what we have.
Well, my position is they don't allege an antitrust injury in their complaint flowing from the building of the Highlands themselves, or the relationship between the university and the foundation. It's very clear in their complaint, they even have a section, their amended complaint, I'm sorry, a section called antitrust injury to plaintiffs. I believe it's paragraph 64. Very clear, as described in paragraph 50, which I will return to, the occupancy rates in plaintiffs' facilities have declined substantially since the 2011 housing restriction went into effect. Consequently, revenues generated by plaintiffs' facilities have dropped substantially, causing great economic harm to plaintiffs. There are that concept, that allegation tied to the 2011 housing restriction, I call it the amended policy, is repeated numerous times from paragraphs 48 to paragraph 64. There is no allegation specifically, there's background about how the university and the foundation entered into this partnership, this public-private partnership, like at least 10 of the other PASHI institutions in this Commonwealth have done over the years, in order to construct their housing. So, as pled, and this is a motion to dismiss, the only antitrust injury alleged derives from the amendment of the housing policy in 2011. I am prepared to address the broader concept of the partnership because...
what we need is a predicate, though, to reach a conclusion that the university is a sovereign actor, right?
The university is a sovereign actor,
right.
Yes.
And that is why?
And that is why? Yes. Why are they a sovereign
actor? It may sound obvious, but just as a
problem. Well, this court has held that on numerous occasions. They are considered to be the arm and alter ego of the state. The enabling statute says that they are established by the legislature, PASHI, and the PASHI system.
Extrapolate that down to the foundation.
I'm sorry?
Extrapolate that down to the foundation.
Well, the foundation, like again, many private and public universities have foundations, private entities, with whom they engage in a variety of different activities.
And Mr. Wilford, part of this point is that the reason for the foundation here is to basically get around all the market-based competitive requirements in the statute, in the PASHI statute.
Well, that's an unsupported and very conclusory allegation that they, frankly, didn't even raise in their amended pleading either. It's developed through briefing. The fact is, if there was, and as a matter of fact, there at least did require everybody to abide by the procurement laws. That any avoidance of the procurement laws is what we're really talking, competitive bidding, had to do with the construction of the housing itself, not the amendment of the policy which caused the injury that's complained of by the appellants. So I guess the initial point I would make is it's really not germane how they got there. Secondly, under Omni, City of Columbia versus Omni Advertising, this court, under principles of federalism, doesn't look behind the manner in which the state acts, but rather simply said, did the state have the authority to do what it did? And clearly, the enabling statute for PASHI says that, in the very first section, that institutions must provide appropriate educational and student living facilities. I mean, that's the very first thing that they provide in the enabling legislation. So clearly the university had the authority to provide the housing they provided. How they got there is not, with all due respect, an issue that the federal courts get into in an antitrust situation, as long as there was authority to engage in the act.
Well, but that's what's been pleaded, is a Sherman Act violation.
Correct.
Clearly, There's no question about jurisdiction. There's no issue here as to abstention. We're dealing with a federal issue that also implicates an exception. And so we're by way of immunity. There are various forms of immunity that might apply here, right? The district courts applied ipso facto immunity. But I'm not sure that's right.
Well, the district court applied Parker immunity because the district court viewed all of the anti-competitive acts as well as the anti-competitive injuries resulting from those acts as having been the direct result of actions of the university acting within the authority that it was granted by the PASHI enabling statute. Under those circumstances, Parker governs because Parker says that when the state acts in conjunction with or in collaboration with a private party, if it's the state that's doing the acting, that private party also is immunized. Otherwise, every single antitrust plaintiff would be end running by suing the private party with whom the state may have contracted.
If this district court had applied Medi-Cal, would it have come to the same place?
Yes, Your Honor. We took the position that it wasn't necessary to get there. Yes, the clearly articulated derives from the statutory scheme. The requirement that they provide appropriate educational facilities, including appropriate student living facilities.
Is it a statutory scheme or a regulatory scheme?
I'm sorry?
Is it a statutory scheme or a regulatory scheme?
It's a statute that creates a PASHI system and then provides powers, authorities, checks, and balance review by the different layers of the in the PASHI system. The lowest layer being the university and university presidents that are governed by a council of trustees who then are reviewed and accountable to the PASHI board. It's a statute that created the PASHI system and sets forth its powers and structure.
The district court did not get into Nora Pennington, but would that be an easier way to get to the same place?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I'm glad you raised it because I didn't mean to leave that out. The district court did not rule on that, but that's an entirely different and actually a broader immunity than Parker's. Let me specifically address the amendment of the policy because that is the injury that they complain of. They've admitted in their briefs and in their pleadings that the university sets the rates for the housing and established the policy in the first place and amended the policy. Foundation had no ability to do that. But let's assume through discovery the worst case scenario is that the executive director of the foundation ran across the commons to the university office of the president and said, you need to do something, I need more students because I can't pay the bonds. So the university changes its policy for the exact reason that Mr. Wolford contends. That is clearly petitioning the state under NOR, and it would be immune because the action, the amendment of the policy, came from the state. So it's state action, but we as a private party petitioned to make it happen. We are immune under NOR Pennington. The other point that I wanted to make, I have 9 seconds, the Highlands replaced existing housing. They tore down housing to make room for the Highlands, and then they also took more housing offline. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, you. Mr. McCullough.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kamal Alexander Marichli, and I represent H. Fred Walker, sued in his official capacity as the president of Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania in the form of an ex parte exception to the 11th Amendment for injunctive relief prospectively. It is our position that, as in fact, representing Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania, that the district court got it right in determining that Parker immunity applied to the actions of Edinburgh University in amending its parietal rule to increase on-campus residency requirements from merely the freshman year to the sophomore year, and as well, and that this was in fact an action that's quintessentially justifiable under Parker immunity, because what little we know about Parker immunity comes from the cases of Parker and Hoover themselves and this court's decision in A.B. Bedell in the tobacco settlement case. And it's clear in those instances that Parker immunity is applicable in circumstances where you can say, has the state chosen to act within its traditional sovereign powers as a state? And then if the answer is yes, Parker immunity applies. Whether or not that action is anti-competitive or not, whether or not characterizations of malice, ill will, or greed are raised or not, whether or not it acts in conspiracy allegedly with a private party or not, if the state has chosen to act within an area within its traditional authority as a sovereign state and does so, then Parker immunity applies. Put another way, in the A.D. Bedell case, this court says it's the nature of the action in question, and if it's a solitary, meaning an act carried out only by the state itself, act of the state within a traditional area of its purview, then in fact Parker immunity applies. Now, here we've had a lot of discussion from my learned opponent and from my able co-counsel for the...
Is he not learned?
He's learned too.
Isn't that able?
Yes, I just wanted to vary my adjectives.
I see.
He's not only able, but learned.
That's too bad.
And indeed, he's not only learned, but able. So okay. I want to reflect a parody to my brothers in the bar here, who have presented you, if nothing else, with an interesting and challenging case. But I think it's a case that's more apparently complex than it actually is in terms of the law, in terms of public policy, in terms of society, in terms of educational policy. It's imponderable. But in terms of the law, it's very simple. And that is, Edinburgh University, Pennsylvania, is an arm of the state. There's a host of 11th Amendment cases, including the Skehan case from your court, but also a published opinion by former Chief Judge of the Western District, Judge Ambrose, in a district court opinion that comprehensively discusses why a constituent of the state system of higher education is in fact an arm of the state or an alter ego. So I don't believe, and on that basis, that similar basis, we indicate that in fact Edinburgh University is an arm of the state, and indeed the appellants concede that much, that it is a state agency. So there's no question that the state is acting here when Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania acts. The matter of Parker immunity is, again, a simple question of whether or not the state has acted within an area within its traditional authority. How do we determine that? I suggest we determine that by means of the enabling statute, which I was about to say has been most ably discussed here. And it says, in connection with Pennsylvania's constitutional requirement to provide public education, that the Pennsylvania state system of higher education is to provide public higher education. And it also says that in connection with that, it is to provide student housing. And so we have that. On top of it, you have, and I regret to say it's stated only in my able and learned friend's brief at pages 26 and 27, footnote 8, but it's quite clear that on-campus residency requirements have been a staple of the American college experience. There's three cases involving private university jail, Hamilton and Colgate, in which challenges to on-campus residency requirements survived antitrust rules. So for both of those reasons, for the fact that it's in connection with providing student housing, and in fact it's a traditional aspect of student housing, and it's a state agency that's doing this, we have a quintessential example of Parker immunity. My final point, because I see my time is up, is that if you use the Mid-Cal test in arguendo, hypothetically, we would pass it. This is an odd day to be talking about what is or is not reasonably foreseeable. But in any case, I would suggest that it is reasonably foreseeable. Thank you.
Well, why don't you end on that point?
Okay. But in any case, it's reasonably foreseeable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolford, we'll hear you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. Number one, Your Honor asked what were the overt acts. They were actually in my brief on page 25, and they include. The basic idea here is that there was an overall anti-competitive agreement, and there were a number of overt acts in furtherance of it. Yes, the housing change was one of them, but we wouldn't have needed a housing change to fill up the facilities had they not been built in the first place.
But do you agree with the proposition, as I understand from your learned naval counsel opponent, the brothers in the bar, that the policy that caused the injury was driven by the residence requirement?
It's all of it. Because if there weren't facilities to fill across the street, then there wouldn't have been a need to change the policy to fill them. One of the problems is they overbuilt this thing. And in my brief, I think it was the reply, I noted that the purpose of the advertising, competitive bidding, and other things that are actually in the enabling statute that they ignored and circumvented, that it's not just to make those processes go. It's also to safeguard tax dollars. It's to prevent imprudent construction, things like that. This thing was way overbuilt. I was at Penn State last week and watched a great football game, graduated from there, hadn't been there in a long time. I'm walking down the street, and guess what? The dormitory that I lived in is still there, okay? There's no reason to knock it down and change it and make it look more like the place across the street. It's still there. And as Mr. McCullough just told you, they already had residential housing. They were fulfilling their statutory, their constitutional mandate to have housing. But they wanted upscale housing. They wanted stuff that was nicer. They want to keep up with the Joneses because that's what
they want. No, they want student applicants who end up wanting to go there. That's why there is so much change on campuses and
exactly
offering
right.
different facilities,
exactly right.
student facilities, and better housing.
But that's the essence of the competition. Now they're competing. That's not their mission.
They're competing with other universities.
Well, they're competing with any university, private and public, and as long as they're doing it within the confines of their enabling statute, I guess that's okay. But they're competing. And so when we look at their enabling statute, what does it say? Well, it says they have certain broad powers, and as I pointed out, originally they didn't have construction project authority. And if you compare the two statutes that I cited in my brief, you'll see when the legislature wants to grant that authority, they know how to do it. They didn't do it. Instead, they amended the statute years later to give them that authority. Well, you can't just say, well, we have this broad-based authority, but we're going to ignore the very provision that gave authority in the first place. That is what you have to follow. And there's Pennsylvania case law. It's pretty clear that once the General Assembly promulgates a statute to further a constitutional requirement, that is tantamount to the constitutional requirement. You can't say, well, there's some other constitutional thing. This is what the legislature said to do. And that's what they didn't do. So you can't say that they're following a constitutional mandate when they didn't follow it the way that the legislature intended. I'll just address one other thing. Or actually, two other things.
Quickly, please.
Ask for permission first.
Quickly, please.
We're out of time.
Okay. Am I done?
You may do so. Just quickly, please.
Okay. I just wanted to respond to your question. You said, is this a statutory scheme or a regulatory scheme?
Right.
It's primarily a statutory scheme. There's one regulatory provision in the statute, and that's the one that they didn't follow. That's the one that prescribes how you're supposed to construct facilities, and they chose not to follow that. Otherwise, it's more a statutory scheme. And the other thing is on the Pennington question, in order to answer your question, Mr. McCullough had to assume facts. That's the problem.
because we think that the agreement to fill up that housing was entered into before there was a problem. And that's part of the anti-competitive conspiracy. I don't think the foundation went across the street and said, hey, we've got to fill this up, we can't pay our bills. That was part of the deal in the first place.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wolford. Thank you to all of counsel, all learned and able. And I will ask the clerk to adjourn the proceedings.
The court stands adjourned until Thursday.